whatever in your own mic. You don't need that one.
Oh, okay.
And here's your water.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here today. I was very excited when I came up here for the first time and saw what Wes has and his helpers have accomplished here, that this is indeed a very exciting time for all of us, as Kathy said yesterday, and because the opportunities are actually opening up. What we are achieving as citizens is being accomplished in spite of the greatest criminal network in the world. So what these criminals are actually doing is inspiring us to achieve even greater things. And the new economy, which they talk about, is simply the achievements of the citizens to thwart the criminals in their ongoing conspiracy. And as I pointed out, the criminals realize that if you want to steal from everybody. Don't just take a gun and go and hold up one person. You want to hold up everybody in the world. And of course, what I'm talking about here today is my life as a detective, which was the last thing in the world I ever expected to be. I expected to be a romance novelist and to lead a bohemian life, have a house in the south of France, and do the Ernest Hemingway routine, you know. Have a few movie scripts and so forth, but it just hasn't worked out that way because I met an indicted person named Ezra Pound who had been indicted for treason because he tried to persuade the people of the United States not to enter World War II. Now, if there's one thing that the criminals hate, they hate a person who interferes with their war plans because war is the most profitable thing they can get into. They create enormous debts, which they can live on for many years from the interest. And so when you become a pacifist, which is essentially what Ezra Pound was, then you incur their lifelong enmity. Now, Ezra Pound was indicted for treason. There was a story in a paper in Virginia just a couple of weeks ago about me, and on the front page they said Ezra Pound had been imprisoned for treason, which was of course a total lie, as was most of the other story too, and I'll be suing them when I get back. I didn't have time to get the lawsuit ready, and of course there's no hurry about it anyway, because there's no statute of limitations on conspiracy. So you can take your time, and it's always better to proceed cautiously and prepare your material. And when you go into court, it's really already a fait accompli. You've got everything there that you need. And my principle, which I'll go into tomorrow about law, is that I discovered that our legal system is so complex that no lawsuit can ever really be ended. You can just keep it going forever. And of course, most people can't because they don't have the funds, because the lawyers have set it up so they'll bleed you dry within about 18 months. So no matter what you want to do or how good your case is, you can no longer proceed because the lawyer's already taken all your money. So Ezra Pound was never tried, was never in prison for treason, but probably his greatest crime in the eyes of the criminals was that he set me loose on the Federal Reserve System, which happened in 1948. And when he said, I met him at the Federal Hospital for the Insane, it's called, St. Elizabeth's, which is a place where they put political prisoners. And fortunately for him, his wife came over from England, and so they could not proceed with the treatments which they usually give people there. And he was imprisoned in what they call the hellhole, which is the MR, the male receiving ward. And this is the most violent people who are brought into St. Elizabeth's. And they put Ezra down in this human hellhole, and he was there for about 6 months. And his friend T.S. Eliot, who had come over to be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, saw the conditions he was in, and he absolutely went through the roof, and he had to move him to a quieter ward, Chestnut Ward. And that's where I met him, in the chestnut ward with the other chestnuts. And so one of the first things that Ezra said to me, he said, I would like for you to look into the Federal Reserve System. Well, I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System. I was 25 years old, never had a bank account, and was living on a very modest stipend from the government to go to college. So he said, well, look in your wallet. So I looked in the wallet, and there on the bill it said Federal Reserve, which I had never noticed and which I'm sure nobody else in the United States ever noticed. It was a Federal Reserve note. And interestingly enough, it was not money at all. It was a green dollar bill. But it was such fake money, such counterfeit money with nothing behind it, that Congress finally had to pass a special law, the Legal Tender Act, making this counterfeit money legal tender, which meant that before the Congressional Lawful Tender Act, it was not lawful money. So we had been using unlawful money for years. Now, by act of Congress, it was suddenly lawful. But it was still the same fake money that it was before, because it was not money. It's a promissory note. The Federal Reserve note is issued against government bonds. In other words, it's a paper bill issued against paper backing. Now, there's no gold, there's no diamonds, there's no nothing behind it except the people's promise to pay. Because the Federal Reserve Act was written in 1913 stating that they were giving this privately owned bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, license to print money, which is what a central bank does. The central bank has a license to print money, and all the money that it prints becomes the liability of the government. And of course, there is no government, there's only taxpayers. So all the money that these bankers print and issue and circulate is charged against the taxpayers. And they have to pay interest on it. It's called interest-bearing currency. One of the first things that Ezra Pound told me, he says, you have to learn the difference between interest-bearing currency and non-interest-bearing currency. Well, he might as well have been talking Greek to me. I never heard such confusing terms in my knowledge. Because I thought, how can currency be interest-bearing? But it is. All the currency is interest-bearing. And we have two dead presidents who could testify to that, because in 1863, President Lincoln, in order to finance the war, which the bankers did not want him to finance the war, they wanted the United States to split into two small countries, the North and the South. So they wouldn't lend him any money to fight the war. And he called in the bankers and he said, look, I've got to finance the war. I want to borrow some money. They said, well, yes, you can have money at the 19% interest. Well, the average interest rate at that time was 1%. So Lincoln knew that the bankers were having him on. So he looked around and someone told him, well, the Treasury lawfully can issue money, which is non-interest-bearing, called greenbacks. And so Lincoln said, well, I'll do that. And so he issued the greenback currency, non-interest-bearing currency, and financed the Civil War with that. Well, of course, the bankers were very annoyed by this because they lost a lot of money on the interest that they would have gotten on interest-bearing currency. So when you cross the bankers, they have only one answer, and that's assassination. So they assassinated Lincoln. Well, 100 years later, we get another young, bright president, John F. Kennedy, who had gone to Harvard, but apparently did not take any history courses, because someone told him, Kennedy, like most presidents, wanted to be remembered. And he asked some of his advisors, what could I do to really get the people behind me and have them appreciate me for what I've done? And so one of them said, why don't you go after the Federal Reserve System? They said, if you will get the Federal Reserve System off the backs of the American people, they'll put statues of you in every town in the United States. So Kennedy thought, well, that's a very attractive proposition. I think I'll do that. So he goes over to the Treasury and says, print me up some non-interest-bearing currency, the greenback currency. Well, they did this. And, of course, then the bankers, again, were horrified. They said, well, what is this guy doing? He's going to ruin us. So they hurriedly he had this vice president named Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Kennedy had already decided to dump Johnson, which meant that his political future was nil. And so Johnson said to Kennedy, well, look, we're having a little trouble with the party down in Texas. Why don't you go down to Dallas and see what you can do? So when Kennedy went to Dallas, they had not one, they had five different assassination teams waiting for him. In case one didn't make it, the other would back up, you know. So Kennedy didn't make it, and that was the end of the greenback currency on Kennedy. So he went the same way as Lincoln, simply because he issued non-interest-bearing currency, which I admit is confusing and sounds dull and routine, but unfortunately, this is the way that the world operates. These bankers are always conspirators, they're criminals, and they'll do anything to keep their system going. So, and that is why we had an anarchist in France in the 19th century named Proudhon. And Proudhon was a philosopher of some repute. And after many years of studying, he issued his dictum. He said, all government is a crime. He didn't say some government, or some parts of the government may be a little criminal. He said, all government is a crime, which is true. And why is all government a crime? It's because part of government is law enforcement. And when people get into government and they realize they control the law enforcement, then this becomes a license to commit whatever crimes they want, a license to steal, a license to lead the country into wars, anything they want to do. And this is a very heady situation. They suddenly realize, here I am, I've reached power, I can do anything I want, no one can control me. And so this is why all government becomes a crime. And of course the people have really only one solution, and that is revolution. That's what Thomas Jefferson said. To have a successful government, you have to have a revolution every 25 years. Well, he said that 200 years ago, so we're a little overdue. But let's hope for the best. And because the United States was founded on revolution, and it's a revolutionary state, so revolution is really great. I have nothing against it. And look forward to it, as a matter of fact. And instead of my life as an artist and a bohemian, my life has been lived as a revolutionary, which was not what I intended at all. And in fact, I'm a person who avoids confrontation, and I like to take it the easy way. I don't go looking for fights and so forth. And the result was that J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, who had his eye on me for some time, he announced that I was the most dangerous man in America. Well, from his point of view, I was. But I wasn't a threat to my fellow Americans. They had nothing to fear from me. But J. Edgar Hoover and the criminals did. And so that's why they designated me with that title. And, of course, I was under daily surveillance by the FBI for 33 years. And I would actually come out of my apartment in Chicago. There'd be a row of cars with FBI agents. And as I stepped out, they would ostentatiously take their telephones from the dash and talk and make sure that I could see that all this is going on, and that I would collapse in total fear at this terrible fate that was waiting for me. So I just walked by and I thought, well, look, gee, all this attention is nice, you know. Don't know what I've done to deserve it, but and they spent millions of dollars to keep me under surveillance. And of course, during that entire time, I never even got a parking ticket, because when you're under daily surveillance by the FBI, it limits your activities. You can't go around robbing banks or so I had to be a good citizen whether I wanted to be or not. Because they had all of the instruments of modern communications. They had videos and they had bugs on my telephone and so forth. And so I just had to behave myself, which I managed to do, but I certainly did not like it. But actually, I started out, as I say, as the protege of a man who was indicted but never tried for treason. Ezra Pound was indicted for treason by a associate of President Roosevelt's at the White House named Alger Hiss. He had Ezra Pound indicted for treason, and then, of course, he became one of the most famous traitors in the United States himself. But Alger Hiss had Ezra Pound indicted for treason because Alger Hiss was a KGB agent, and, of course, as a loyal communist, he considered Ezra Pound a fascist, an anti-communist, and a real threat. So they both wound up in prison, but Ezra used to complain. They kept him for 13 and a half years, and Alger Hiss only served 6 years. And when Alger Hiss got out, he got a government pension. Ezra Pound got no pension at all because he had, of course, never been in the government itself. But when I met Ezra Pound, I was taken there by one of my professors at the art school in Washington I was attending at that time. And I could not understand why Ezra Pound would want to talk to me, you know. I didn't know anything. So I got over there and I found out that being a prisoner, he needed people coming in to talk to him. And he did have, over the period of 13 years he was there, he had 3,800 people come from all over the world to sit at his feet and to learn from him. So he was always a teacher. And he started right in. When I walked in, it was winter time there in Chestnut Ward. It was very dark and gloomy in the afternoon. And I was let in by a keeper who had an enormous collection of keys, bigger than my leg, hanging from his waist. And he unlocked his door, and I walked in, and then he closed the door and locked it behind me. And you always have a little feeling, well, do you wonder if he'll ever unlock it for you? Maybe this is their chance, you know, to have me in there. So I walked in, I saw Ezra Pound sitting there, a very distinguished-looking person, and suddenly it struck me, this man hasn't committed any crime. What is he doing sitting here? Why is he a prisoner? And I got so angry that my whole head turned black, and I was so enraged that I just thought then, I'm going to try to get him out of here. And I've never been so angry in my life, and that anger has lasted well over 50 years because nothing has been corrected. I did finally get Ezra Pound out of St. Elizabeth, and the government dropped all charges against him. Well, in fact, early in our association, I said to Ezra, well, what are your prospects here? And he said, well, I expect the government to drop all charges and to release me. And so when he told me that, I thought, well, he really must be crazy because there's no way this government's going to drop these charges. And so he asked me to ask around because I knew a lot of influential people in Washington through George Stimson at the Press Club. And so he said, ask around and see what you think you can find out. So I asked George Stimson, I said, would you ask people around, what does the government plan to do with Ezra Pound? Are they just going to keep him for a few years and drop the thing, or what are they going to do? So George asked a couple of people in Washington who were proteges of his. One of them was General Lucius Clay, the hero of the Berlin airlift. Another one was a Supreme Court Justice, Tom Clark. Tom Clark, by the way, got on the Supreme Court of the United States with a brilliant background. He was a lawyer for the mafia. And so they figured, well, why not? Why don't we just put a guy on the Supreme Court? So they put Tom Clark on the Supreme Court. His son, Ramsey Clark, by the way, is a very famous dissenting lawyer at the present time. And but he asked Tom Clark and he asked General Clay and someone else, what is Ezra Pound's chances? So a few days later, I saw George and I said, what did they say? And George says, well, they all say that the whole power of the government is dedicated to keeping Ezra Pound there for the rest of his life. He'll never be released. And, of course, this was very depressing news. It was not news that I could take back to St. Elizabeth, so I never told Ezra any of this. But in my own mind, I was convinced that George had said was right. They intended never to release him because they treated Jefferson Davis the same way after the Civil War. They threw him into prison in a dungeon, very brutally treated, and he stayed there for years. No trial. They finally released him. But so I continued to visit Ezra and got started on the Federal Reserve investigation. And I found that it was indeed a criminal conspiracy. Plus, it was not a public bank, as people thought, with the name Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve is like Federal Express, you know. It's a private company. And there are no reserves because they create money out of nothing. And, you know, in the Bible it said, and God created the earth. But it does not say anything about God created money. So people came onto the earth and they had no money. Apparently God overlooked something there. And I don't think he ever dreamed that we'd need money, because in a just society, you would not need money. People would do things for each other. And that would be it. You wouldn't need gold and silver, any of that stuff. But people didn't do things the way God thought he wanted them to, or planned for them to, and so that they began to need money in order to transact business with each other. And of course, this created the opportunity for criminals, because as Amschel Rothschild said, give me the right to issue a nation's money, and I can control, I don't care what laws they make. And that's the situation we have today, because the private bankers issue the money, print all the money they want, and then they bribe the lawmakers. Doesn't matter if it takes $1 million or $5 million, they're printing the money anyway. So they go to the lawmakers and said, here's $1 million, and I want you to pass our bill. And of course, the lawmaker doesn't have any working citizens coming up and saying, here's $1 million, we want you to pass bills for us. And so the banker is the only one who brings in any money, so he's the one who gets the laws passed. And that's a system that you have, which is called democracy. It's called democracy because it's the rule of the mob. But it's not, it's the rule of the bankers, but the mob is controlled by money. So it's actually the rule of the mob. And that's why you have legislatures which pass laws to rob the people, to rob the 6 billion people of the world. Now, how do the bankers rob the 6 billion people of the world? Because that sounds pretty difficult. It's not difficult at all once you get your system going. It's a consortium of central banks throughout the world, each of which has the license to print money. Now, Ezra told me very early in our relationship, he said, sovereignty, a nation's control of its own destiny, lies in the right to issue money and the right to control foreign policy. Well, of course, you citizens have no right to issue money, and you have no voice in foreign policy. I don't think anybody in this room has any voice in foreign policy. That's all decided for you by the people, the elites, who consider themselves your betters. They consider themselves better than you because they don't have more money than you. They have all the money because they can print all that they want. And, of course, they have, in case you get the inspiration, well, I'll print some money, too, then they throw you into prison. You're a counterfeiter. So you either use their counterfeit money or you go to prison if you try to use your own. It's that simple, and that's the way it works. Now, they also have another means of control, which is which encompasses everybody. Nobody can escape it, and that's called the tax, the income tax. Now, if these people had the license to print money, why would they need your income tax? Because they can print all the money they want. They don't care if you have $1,000 or $200,000. They don't need your money. But the income tax was instituted solely for control. Not only to control you, but to control the volume and flow of money. Because all central banks, with their right to issue money, are inflationary. Because they can print all they want. There's absolutely nothing in the laws which says they can only print $1 million a day or anything like that. It's unlimited. And all that money becomes your obligation, interest-bearing currency obligation. You're paying interest on all this money that the bankers are having such fun printing and bribing your legislators with. So the Federal Reserve is a privately owned bank, had to control this inflationary money, and all central banks have to do this because the printing presses are running and the money is flowing out, and they have to have some control. Well, the control is the income tax, because He let people have the money and wages. They have to work for it. Nobody gives them anything, but they have to work for it. So, and then as they earn the money, the government takes it back as income tax. So they give what they call the subsistence wage. Now, the subsistence wage was developed in England by the Rothschilds about 1810. And they developed a system. They said, well, we want people to work, and we want them to work hard, but we cannot allow them to accumulate any assets. So therefore, we will give them a subsistence wage, and if they begin to save money, we'll tax it and take it away from them. And so this is what the subsistence wage is. And in all the so-called democracies, the subsistence wage is the fate of the workers. The worker bees have to live on a subsistence wage. They cannot get rich, and they cannot have the finer things of life because the government takes it back. In fact, I defined the difference between capitalism and communism many years ago. I said, under communism, profit is considered evil. You are not supposed to exploit your fellow citizens by making a profit. So the government says you cannot make a profit. Well, there you take away the motivation for all economic activity. If you can't make a profit, why do it? So this gives the government, the communist government, the opportunity to control all economic activity because they won't have any competition for the people, because who's going to get out there and make things and work if they can't make a profit? Now, the capitalist country is entirely different. Under capitalism, the government says, go out and work hard and make all the profit you can. We don't care how much profit you make. And after you make the profit, the government takes the profit away from you and gives it to the communist countries. So that's the difference between capitalism and communism. Now, all during the Cold War, when we were spending $250 billion a year on defense to protect us from the Soviet menace, the menace of world communism, the Soviet state was living entirely on largesse from the United States taxpayers, and a lot from Canada, too. Canada was selling the Soviets wheat because the Soviets and the Bolshevik Revolution, the Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. They had the most wonderful wheat, and they fed all of Europe from this Ukrainian breadbasket. Well, the communist leaders, being mostly intellectuals who had never been on a farm, and they had no idea where food came from, they decided to kill the peasants. In fact, the joke in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution was, this is the workers' and peasants' party. They enslave the workers and kill the peasants. And that's why it's the peasants and workers' party. So that's the story of communism. And so from 1917 on, the United States taxpayers were the total support of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. In fact, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which was the central bank of the entire Federal Reserve system, most of its effort during the 1920s was dedicated to shoring up the collapsing communist system. See, the communist system collapsed almost immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 because the workers and peasants said, look, we own everything. We don't have to take care of anything because it's ours. And there was a story about a peasant who burned down a huge forest. And so they said to this peasant, why did you burn down the forest? He said, because it's ours now. We can do whatever we want. So they burned it down. And, of course, they stopped growing wheat. So Herbert Hoover, who later became known as an anti-communist because he saved communism, you have a lot of these paradoxes in this kind of work. I have to tell you, you have to have a very flexible reasoning capacity, because Herbert Hoover became world famous as an anti-communist because he saved communism. And if you could figure that out, tell me. I'd like to know. And in fact, he set up the Hoover Institute at Stanford, California, called the Hoover Institute of War, Peace, and Revolution. And today it's very active. In fact, the whole Reagan administration in 1980 was pulled out of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. And these were called the neoconservatives. And Reagan had a neoconservative administration. And they were all at Hoover Institute, and they were all old-line socialists. So the great Reagan Revolution, anti-communist revolution, Reagan is standing up there saying the Soviet Union is the evil empire, and his whole administration was socialists behind him. He didn't know that, of course. Reagan wouldn't have known a socialist if one came up and bit him on the leg, but he was a Hollywood actor and a very good one. And, of course, his presidency was the culmination of his entire acting career. He was the best speaker, the most charismatic president we've ever had and ever will have, as a matter of fact. And so he simply played his role to perfection, and he was very good at it. And meanwhile, these neoconservative socialists ran the whole country.
Sorry, can I have to cover your mic with your pad,
please? Oh, don't cover it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. So the Reagan Revolution was really a neoconservative revolution in which the socialists ran the country to suit themselves, and they ran up an enormous deficit, which created more interest for the bankers. And of course, this all went back to Thanksgiving week of 1910, as I discovered at the Library of Congress. I went to the Library of Congress and started digging out some things back in 1948, and I found that there had been a secret meeting of the bankers at Jekyll Island in 1910, and these were the most important bankers in New York. They got on a train in Hoboken to go down to Brunswick, Georgia. And Brunswick is a very interesting name because Brunswick was the origin of the Hanover family, the Dukes of Hanover, who became the kings of England in 1700. And they became the kings of England by some faked genealogy, which they had an obliging scholar draw up for them. And so they went to England to become the kings of England. They didn't even speak English. The first three Georges of Hanover dynasty in England didn't speak English and didn't see why they should bother to learn it, because German was their language. And so here you had the leaders of Britain speaking only German. And finally, I think they did learn some English. And of course, today, Queen Elizabeth does speak English, but it took a while. Because these people have so much power, they do whatever they want. They say, I'm not going to bother to speak English in London. Let the English people speak, learn German, you know. They want to talk to me. So that was the Hanover dynasty, which happened to be the Illuminati and Freemasonry originated in Hanover province. And Brunswick, Georgia was named after the Brunswick Hanover family. And so this is where these bankers, their train went to Brunswick, Georgia. Then they went across the inlet to the Jekyll Island, which they had bought a few years earlier and made a private enclave. And the residents of Jekyll Island at that time comprised one-sixth of the wealth of the entire world. So these people were not Johnny-come-latelys. They knew what they were doing. And so they had their private meeting, and they got rid of all the servants on Jekyll Island and for their private meeting. And they brought in new servants, and they agreed they would only call each other by their first names. Paul Warburg was Paul, and Nelson Aldrich was Nelson. And ever after, they were known as the First Name Club because they only used first names. And all these people agreed they would never mention the fact that they had ever been on Jekyll Island. Because what they did there was to secretly write the Federal Reserve Act with our central bank plan. Now, they had been trying to get a central bank in the United States since 1787. And the first bank of the United States, which was a central bank, was enacted over the opposition of Thomas Jefferson. And in my book, I quote Thomas Jefferson's opposition to it. He was just a farmer in Virginia, but he had an understanding of international banking, which is absolutely incredible. So he put down all the list of why you should oppose the central bank. But Alexander Hamilton persuaded George Washington to approve the plans for the First Bank of the United States. So Washington approved it. But then when Jefferson became president and the First Bank of the United States charter came up for renewal, Jefferson, of course, this was his moment. He refused to renew it. Well, the Bank of England, which actually controlled the central bank, was very annoyed. So they declared war on the United States. Now, when you go to school, you're probably taught that the War of 1812 was caused by the fact that British frigates stopped American ships on the high seas and took off their crews and put them to work on their own ships. It's called impressing. Well, that did happen, but that wasn't the reason for the war whatsoever. The war was simply a punitive act against the United States to try to defeat them and bring them back in as a British colony because of they refused to renew the charter of the First Bank of the United States. Well, and of course you had this war in which, of course, Canada was on the side of the British during the War of 1812, and they actually burned Washington, but we survived. And so then they set up a second central bank called the Second Bank of the United States. And along comes the hero of the War of 1812, General Andrew Jackson. And as president, he said, "By God, you are a gang of vipers, and I will root you out." He had righteous anger against these bankers. So he pulled the government deposits out of the Second Bank of the United States. Well, of course, it immediately collapsed in 1836. That was the end of the second central bank that we had in this country. So in revenge, the Bank of England issued an order that no paper would be honored from the United States. All American securities, stocks, bonds were worthless as of that date. So we had our first financial collapse in the United States, the Panic of 1837. And it was caused simply as a punitive action, because when you make the bankers mad, they don't sit around and brood, they do something about it. Like they murder Lincoln, they murder Kennedy, and so forth. And so they put the entire United States into financial collapse. Well, then the agents of the Rothschilds bought up these American securities for 1 cent on the dollar, and you created the first big fortunes in the United States. Our first millionaires were all created by the Panic of 1837, and they more or less became the agents of the Bank of England in the United States, because their fortunes were entirely due to the outside influence. And of course, the American people had no idea what was going on. They just knew we suddenly had a new class of millionaires, and the fact that they were all foreign agents never dawned on anybody. And so it's gone that way ever since. I have been meaning to write a monetary history of the United States, showing that everything that happened in the States and everything that happens here in Canada is engineered by the bankers, because their program comes first. The people come last. The only thing the people have to worry about is how to pay the interest on these enormous debts which the bankers create out of nothing. That's your problem. You've got to come up with that interest. Before you buy food or anything else, you've got to pay that interest. Because, you see, it's a moral obligation. You should pay your debts, you know. And they always come. It's amazing. The bankers are totally corrupt and totally without scruples. But they always bring in the fact that you have a moral obligation to pay your debts. And so people believe that. They say, "Oh, yes, I don't want my credit impugned, and I want to be a good citizen, so I'm going to see to it that we pay these debts, even if we don't have any food on the table." And but they usually manage to give you a little food, too. We get back to the subsistence wage. They don't want you to starve to death. They don't want you to get fat, but they they certainly want you to survive from day to day, and that's what they do. And, of course, this has a devastating effect on the morals of the country. I have claimed for years that the Federal Reserve System and the Central Bank, which you have here, has a very depressing moral effect on the entire population. Because instead of people being constructive and building their lives and having constructive careers, their first obligation is to pay all this interest to the bankers. After that, you can start having some moral scruples, but until you pay that interest, you cannot do anything. And that comes first. So they've trained people to do this, that they must pay their debts. Even though the people don't owe these debts, the people didn't incur these debts, and the people don't even owe the interest, because it's all created out of nothing. And that is Kabbalistic, because creating things out of nothing is God's purpose on earth. But it's not up to mere humans to create things out of nothing. So when they create money out of nothing, they're superseding the will of God. They're indulging in Kabbalah, which is black magic. And that's why you have cultism and you have drugs and all these things. It all stems from the Kabbalistic origin of money creation. And so that's what you have to deal with. You're dealing with black magic. And all of the banking system, believe it or not, is black magic. It's not based on what people earn or what they produce. It's based on the Kabbalistic idea of creating something from nothing through incantations, through rituals, through cults. And it's anti-God. It's anti all religious principles. So the people are in this dilemma. They don't understand this. They don't understand that their monetary system is black magic. And so obviously they have no idea what to do about it. Now, in the States, they tell you to write to your congressman. But unfortunately, as I've told people for years, when you write to your congressman, be sure and enclose a $10,000 check. Because if you don't, your letter goes into the wastebasket. Now, if you enclose a $10,000 check, let's say, well, this guy obviously knows what's going on, so we have to pay a little attention to his views. But without the money, they have a saying in Washington, nothing for nothing. And what that means is, if you don't send something, you don't get anything. In other words, it's an investment. The whole democracy is based on individual investment. If you want to invest something in a congressman, then he'll do something for you. I found that out when I tried to get Ezra Pound released from St. Elizabeth's. Well, we went to a couple of senators and congressmen, and they said, oh, you've got a good case. They'll drop the charges against Ezra Pound. And the lowest price, now this was back about 1950. The lowest price we could get was $5,000 before anybody would do anything. Well, everybody that Ezra knew put together didn't have $5,000, you know. And I was living on $50 a month myself, and most of the people I knew were in the same category. So, of course, nothing was done about getting Ezra out at that time. And we didn't know at that time that in Washington, the name of everything is access. If you have access to a congressman or to some public official, then you can get something done. And generally, the only path of access is through money. So if you have no money, the congressman will be very sympathetic, and he say, well, what has been done to Ezra Pound is a terrible injustice, and we've got to do something about it. This will be taken care of, and that's the last you ever hear from. They don't return your calls after that. And as I say, they're waiting for the money. And the idea that this is a money culture has been imposed on us by the bankers. Because actually, money should not be very important. In fact, when I worked for H.L. Hunt, the richest man in the world, he was totally bewildered by me because obviously I had a lot of ability and so forth and a very successful record, but I had no interest in money. And in fact, H.L. Hunt would sometimes get annoyed because the people didn't understand him. They published a story that he was the richest man in the world, and that he had an income of $1 million a week. So he told me later, he snorted. I said, you know, they said you had $1 million a week. He just absolutely snorted. He was very indignant. He said, that wouldn't touch it. He said, I actually had $10 million a week at that time. So he was very offended that the press would tell these lies about him, and he only had $1 million a week. And he was really insulted. Yeah, Texas was a money culture, by the way, even at that time. If you didn't have over $100 million, you were considered a very poor person. You were not a player. And you should have at least $300 or $500 million to be a serious player. And so that's the way they judged you in Texas at that time. They judged you by your category, $100 million, $200 million, $1 billion, and so forth. And it's probably pretty much that way today. But that has changed somewhat because, here again, the growth of the bureaucracy in Washington and the increasing power of officials, so the amount of money that you have is not really as important as the access that you have to people. I mean, if you can send President Clinton over a nice-looking intern, then you've got more access than the next guy. And just point her out to the Oval Office and send her down the hall, and things take their course. Yeah, Clinton is a sexual psychopath, you know, that no female could pass the Oval Office without his molesting her. I mean, there was he's what they call in psychiatry compulsive obsessive, and he simply cannot let anybody go by without making his move. And we've never had a president like him, and probably never have another one like that again, because politics itself is an all-absorbing game. It becomes your whole life, you know. You're out there looking for those millions of votes, and so you haven't got time to chase some girl or even a boy up and down the streets. So you just don't have time to fool with it. But Clinton just happened to be one in a million like that who did that. And in fact, his wife Hillary, of course, she was disgusted with him years ago. And Hillary's job at the Rose Law Firm was to bring in new clients. And she recruited new clients by being friendly with them. And that was her job. She wasn't much of a lawyer. She hardly ever had a law case. But she did bring in new clients. And one of them was the poor guy who was found dead as a suicide with a gun that nobody had ever seen and which didn't even work. So that also is the way things are done in Washington. It's called the Washington suicide. They also have the Washington heart attack. A person who really becomes a threat will have what they call a Washington heart attack. That was true of Chief Justice Vinson of the Supreme Court. He was all set to rule against the integration decision in the Supreme Court. I think it was 5-2. And he had a Washington heart attack, and they brought in this guy from California who had murdered his father. And so he ruled that the integration could proceed. And it changed forever the education system in the United States, which is now a total jungle. And if you like jungle life, well, you want to teach school in the United States, because it's different every day, you know. You learn to dodge bullets and knives and the whole work. You don't have much time for teaching, but like I say, every day is very interesting. It's like going to the movies. So we don't want to get too far away from the Federal Reserve System, because what I really want to tell you about today is these consortium of central banks are set up to rob the population of the entire world. We hear about the third world and the developing countries and so forth, and they're being robbed just the way people in Canada and the United States are. It's the same system. It works for everybody. And that's why you send the troops around to different countries to institute some vague purpose, some political purpose, which no one really understands and no one really cares about. But what is going on is the grand Nazi scheme. There's only one political party in the world today, and that's called the Nazis. And you say, well, Adolf Hitler died in 1945, and that was the end of the Nazi party. But that's because you've never been told what the origin of Nazi is. NA is National Socialism, which was the German Nazis. And in 1923, there was a double agent who came to Hitler, and he said to Hitler, look, your Nazi party is not, your National Socialist Party is not getting off the ground. You need an alliance. And he suggested that they ally with the Zionist Party. So the NA of National Socialism joined with the Zionist Party the World Zionist Party in 1923, and ever after was known as the Nazis, NAZI. The ZI was for Zionists, but of course no one knew that, because our popular mythology is that the terrible Nazis were attacking the Jews. But what we were never told is there was a great schism in the Jewish community of the world between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. You see, the non-Zionists were the Orthodox Jews who believed you could not have a Jewish state until the Jewish Messiah came. They didn't acknowledge Christ as Messiah, so they were waiting for their own Jewish Messiah to come. Then you would have a Jewish state, and that Jewish state would rule the world. But the Rothschilds in 1828 decided they couldn't wait for the Jewish Messiah, so they started what they called Reform Judaism under Moses Hess. And Reform Judaism said, yes, you can have a Jewish state before the Messiah comes. And the reason you could have it was the Rothschilds had made so much money, they said, we'll buy our own state. So the Rothschilds sent people out to the Middle East to have Jewish settlements, and which is today the state of Israel, totally created by the Rothschild money. And so Reform Judaism then became the cause of a great schism between Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews. Now, no one has ever told you this, I'm sure, but you think that the Jewish community is monolithic. In fact, it's split sharply down the middle. But even today, they have riots in the Jewish parliament between the Orthodox Jews and the Reform Jews. And they cannot agree on anything because the basic premise is a fundamental disagreement over whether a Jewish state should even exist today. So in Germany in 1923, the German Jews were quite prosperous and quite happy, and they were not interested in becoming Zionists, and they were not interested in going to Palestine. After all, they had beautiful mansions in Germany. They had symphony orchestras, they had art, they had everything, and they were accepted in the community. As Ezra Pound said, Germany was the least anti-Jewish country in Europe. When you went over into Poland and Russia, you had very strong feeling against Jews. But in Germany, they were accepted and happy, so why would you ever have an anti-Jewish government in Germany? And, of course, Hitler, allying himself with the Zionists, he said, after all, you're right. He said, we have the same goals. And so he allied with the Zionist party, and the mission of the Nazis was to force the anti-Zionist Jews to accept Zionism. And this is what the concentration camps were about. They put the anti-Zionist Jews in the concentration camps, and they were placed under the direct administration of the Sonderkommandos, who were the Zionist Jews. So the concentration camps were run by the Zionist Jews in order to punish and get rid of the anti-Zionist Jews, which they did. And, of course, that's a part of the Holocaust that you were never told, that this was a fundamental Jewish disagreement, which the German people, that Daniel Goldhagen wrote a book in which he said all Germans cooperated in their anti-Jewish feeling and the Holocaust, which was not true at all. The Germans did not even know what was going on, most of them. It's just like in the United States, when we were perfecting the atomic bomb and bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the American people knew nothing about it. It was forbidden to mention the atomic bomb. I was serving in the Air Force at that time. We never heard of any atomic mission or atomic bomb until the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So you could say the American people are guilty of the greatest atrocity, the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japanese civilians. But that isn't true. The American people knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about it in the Air Force. And I was right there. So these things go on without the knowledge of the people or the approval of the people. But, of course, they have to accept the results. These things happen, and you're stuck with it. So this is the real story of Zionism, that the Nazis... So then, well, if the Nazis had allied with Zionists, why didn't the Nazi Party survive? Well, what happened was, in 1945, after the German military was defeated, they brought in the German leaders, the German generals, at the Nuremberg trials, tried and convicted and executed them. They had to execute them because they didn't want them around to testify that about the alliance between the Nazis and the Zionists. So they had to die, and they were executed for that reason. Because they told about the atrocities that the German generals had committed. But German generals are like any other generals. They don't really commit atrocities. The troops under their command may commit atrocities, but they don't commit any atrocities themselves. These German generals didn't go around shooting Jews or anybody else. But they were executed, and so the Zionist secret was safe. And now the Zionists were now in command of the world because their National Socialist allies were now gone from history. And the Zionists had a free reign, so they set up the State of Israel. And in fact, some Jews themselves even claim that there should be a statue to Adolf Hitler in Israel because he created the state of Israel, which is absolutely true. Without Adolf Hitler, Israel would not exist. The Jews would still be dispersed and they would have no country. But George Steiner, a very famous Jewish writer, proposed this about 10 years ago. He said, why don't they put up a statue to Adolf Hitler in Israel? Well, they're not likely to. And because there again, the big job of the criminals is to keep the truth from the people. They want, not only do they want you not to find out anything, but they flood you with disinformation. Most of the stuff that you get in the press is absolute lies. And if it's not lies, it's spin or distortions. In other words, they give you 10% of the truth, and the rest is all distortions. And they demonize people so that you're filled with anger against the Holocaust people who murdered all the Jews in Germany. And people do get very angry because of these things. And they don't even know what they're angry about because they're not told the facts. And never will be told the facts because the press is totally in the hands of the bankers. Because news is a high-budget, capital-intensive operation. You need a lot of money. You need a staff covering the whole world, and it's a very expensive situation. So the average truth seeker is not going to start his own television station or newspaper because he doesn't have the $100 million that you need to even get it off the ground. So we're reduced to meetings like this, which are very good. And we also, God apparently was merciful on us, and he gave us the Internet. In fact, in the States, we had this total monopoly of television by three television networks, which were all controlled by Zionists. And so along came cable, and suddenly we had all new stations and all sorts of controversial programs coming on, which, of course, the three Zionist networks would not touch with a 10-foot pole. And the result was they were left behind. They had 100% of the television audience. They now have 30%, and it's dropping every year. In fact, it's probably less than 30%, but they're cooking the books in order to maintain their advertising revenues to give a totally false picture of their audience, which is probably less than half of what they claim, because that's how they keep up their television revenues, based on audience share. So this is all a banker's operation, and I was telling you about the fact that the bankers met in Jekyll Island in 1910. And who was the chairman of this meeting? The chairman of this secret meeting was Senator Nelson Aldrich, the Republican majority leader of the Senate. And, of course, the Republican Party was in full power at that time because after the Civil War, the corporations and banks moved in and took over everything. And they made money so fast that they didn't know what to do with it. And they owned all the railroads and the corporations, and the profits rolled in. And, in fact, they were making so much money that they decided, look, we've got to protect our gains. We don't want any competition. So these corporations passed the Sherman Antitrust Act, which said you cannot compete with the big corporations. Now, they sold this to Congress. They said, look, we want to have free competition. We don't want any restraint of trade. So we're going to pass the Antitrust Act so there will be no more big trusts in the United States. Everything will be open to everybody. Anybody could start a company and do whatever they want. But actually, the Sherman Antitrust Act in operation has always been to stifle competition, that these upstart companies like Bill Gates comes along with Microsoft, and that's why the Justice Department went after him, because this was the true spirit of antitrust, was for the Justice Department to crush Bill Gates, and the lawsuit was brought by his own competitors. They said, Bill Gates has too much of the business. So that's a sin. And of course, the Justice Department is against sin, so they went after Bill Gates. And even though he was the richest man in the world, when the Justice Department went after him, because they could fold him up like a collapsing door because they have so much power, and the Sherman Antitrust Act and all that stuff. But what they were trying to do was send Bill Gates a message, you're now the richest man in the world, and you're spending $1.5 million a year in Washington? This is ridiculous. So so he got the message, and he's now spending about $50 million a year. And because the criminals, they want you to share. If you're making a lot of money, they want you to share it with them. Just be nice. Don't be selfish. And so that's the whole story of the Justice Department. They want you to be nice. And they do it through taxation, and they do it through government force, if that's necessary, and that's what they did. So this is the whole system which was set up in 1694 in England. And what happened was in 1688, England had what they called the Glorious Revolution. And this is part of English history, the Glorious Revolution. What was the Glorious Revolution? The Amsterdam bankers, who at that time were the richest people in the world, they controlled most of banking in the world, they were very unhappy with King James II of England. They were afraid that his daughter, who had married a Catholic, they were going to have a Catholic king of England, and they didn't want this, so because they didn't want... See, Henry VIII had rebelled against the Catholics and taken away all their lands and created a whole new dukedom, which of the people he gave the Catholic lands to. So England had been Protestant after that time. So James II, they thought, my gosh, he's going to go back to a Catholic. So the Amsterdam bankers decided, they had a minor prince in the Netherlands called William. So they decided to finance William, who had a claim to the English throne, a very small claim. They would finance him to invade England and take it over. Well, the problem was William did not have many troops or many ships. He had by no means any amount of military force which he could take over England. So they did it the easy way. They bribed all of King James's admirals and generals to sell him out. And when King William's little flotilla appeared off the coast of England, all of King James's generals and admirals defected to William. So he almost won England without firing a shot. And the purpose of all this was they wanted to set up a central bank in England. So King William set up the Bank of England in 1694. And up to that time, England had, about every 50 years, they'd have a revolution or a war. After the Bank of England was set up, there has never been a revolution in England. Because for a revolution, you need some money. And once the Bank of England took over the finances of the British Empire, nobody ever had any money to object to anything, and so England has enjoyed tranquility for 300 years. It's that simple. Control the money, and you control the people. So the bankers realized they needed intelligence, so they set up the first and best intelligence operation in the world called the British Secret Information Service, SIS. And the purpose of SIS was not merely to gather intelligence, but also to control the opposition. So if there was any opposition, these intelligence operators would infiltrate it and take it over. This is laid down by a Chinese general named Sun Tzu, who said, always control the opposition. Doesn't matter what it is, it can be the Thursday morning garden club or whatever, but you send agents in, and you control it. And in fact, I was very active in right-wing organizations all through the 50s and 60s. And we could always tell a government informant, because he would come in and make the biggest donation. And then he would say, look, you guys are not doing anything. Let's get something going here. Let's blow up a building. I'll get the dynamite. It won't cost you a penny. And we'll take care of everything. And these guys would say, hey, this is good. We'll really get something going. So they'd blow up a building, and then they'd all go to prison for life. because they would have so much testimony against them, when they went to court, they didn't have a chance. And, of course, their lawyers would never plead entrapment or anything like that. And so these guys were on the fast track to 30 years in prison. And this is controlling the opposition, and that's how it's done. So the result is there's very little opposition because it's all infiltrated. And you can always tell the government informant because he is the real activist. And he is the one that brings in the money. If you can't pay the rent on the hall, he pays the rent. You know, this guy is a real patriot, you know. So, so I saw this from the inside for over 30 years. But my work was mostly intellectual, so I wasn't too involved in any of this. But I did make a speech in Coeur d'Alene and Idaho. And I said, I know you Idaho people are great hunters. And I said, you like to hunt bighorn sheep and you like to hunt cougars and so forth. But I said, I think you're missing a bet. I said, I think that the most thrilling sport of all is hunting federal agents. Well, 2 days later, the Murrow Building blows up. And I never heard a word from anybody to this day. But the Spokane paper did a front page story on me and what I had said, you know. And I thought, well, by gosh, now they're going to say that I blew up the Murrow Building. Well, nobody to this day ever said anything. But I was quoted in the New York Times as saying it's a standard government operation, which of course it was. And I had a friend named Red Beckman in Montana. He was quoted on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that this was a standard government operation, which of course it was, because I know the whole patriot movement in the United States, and I have never met anybody who would want to blow up the Murrow Building. I mean, to them, it would be totally counterproductive. Now, if they really wanted to blow up something, they would blow up something in Washington, but they didn't. They went to Heartland America out in Oklahoma, where none of the bureaucrats in Washington would be bruised by the bomb going off, and blew it up there. And the people in Oklahoma, of course, shed tears. And the government rushed in and leveled the entire building and destroyed all the evidence. And then they convicted Timothy McVeigh of killing 168 people with no evidence because they had destroyed the evidence. How you convict somebody after destroying all the evidence, I don't know, but they did. And McVeigh, of course, was a patsy like Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination, that sort of thing. Because there are always these drifters around, and you can pick them up and do anything you want to with them. They're considered throwaways anyway, so nobody cares what happens to them. And I don't know what's ever going to happen to Timothy McVeigh. I seriously doubt that he will ever be executed. I think they'll just let the American people forget about him and go on. But anyway, to get back to Jekyll Island in 1910, Senator Nelson Aldrich, the chairman of this meeting, was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Now, what had happened with John D. Rockefeller, who was financed by the Rothschilds, by the way, so it's really a Rothschild operation, we're trained to think of the Rockefellers as terrible bandits and unscrupulous oligarchs and so forth. Well, in fact, they're nobodies. The Rockefellers are nobody today in this country, but they're a convenient whipping boy. So Rockefeller, after the Rothschilds set him up to be the biggest monopoly in the world, Standard Oil in New Jersey, they looked around for other fields, and so they put him into the medical profession. He revolutionized the medical profession in this country, converted it almost overnight from homeopathy and naturopathy to allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine, which I describe in my book, Murder by Injection, was a German system which relied on radical surgery, lengthy hospital stays, and heavy use of drugs. When I say drugs, I mean drugs. And so they put the medical profession into the drug business. And that was a Rockefeller operation. Then they decided to use Rockefeller to create their central bank and money monopoly. So they set up the National Monetary Commission. In 1907, the bankers in New York precipitated a panic of 1907. And people lost their money, and banks closed, and there was economic chaos. And so obviously, then the bankers set up a public hue and cry for banking reform. You can read about it in the New York Times of that period, that they said, we must have banking reform. Well, of course, all of the devastation, depredation, was caused by the bankers themselves. I mean, these people who put the money in the banks did not cause the banks to fail, and they didn't want to lose their money, but they lost their money. So, banking reform. So, Theodore Roosevelt set up the National Monetary Commission. And the National Monetary Commission was empowered to make recommendations for banking reform. So, The members of this commission, who of course were congressmen, under Nelson Aldrich, the Republican majority leader, they traveled to Europe. They wanted to see how banks worked in Europe. So they were wined and dined by the Rothschilds in Paris and London, and they had a great time for about 2 years, but they did absolutely nothing. And so people sort of forgot about banking reform. And after they had lulled the people into a total false sense of security, then they took off and went to Jekyll Island, to the Millionaires Club, and secretly drafted their central bank plan, which they called the Aldrich Plan after Nelson Aldrich. Well, of course, the Republicans adopted the Aldrich Plan as their platform in 1912. And the banker-controlled press set up a great hue and cry against the Aldrich Plan as the Wall Street Plan, as the big banker's plan. Then they called on Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic candidate, to offer a better plan. So Woodrow Wilson put in the Democratic platform in 1912 the Federal Reserve Plan, which he offered as the alternative to the Aldrich Plan. Now, the interesting thing was it was exactly the same as the Aldrich Plan, but nobody noticed. And so, but they couldn't elect Woodrow Wilson because he was not a very charismatic person. He was a dull professor. He was not a good speaker. He was totally unlikable. So he was born in my hometown, by the way, Stanton, Virginia. That's its only, the only claim to fame in Stanton is that I'm from there and Woodrow Wilson was there. Nobody else ever ever amounted to anything. So so they had this task of electing Woodrow Wilson in order to enact the Federal Reserve Act. But unfortunately, William Howard Taft was very well-liked. He was the president running for re-election. And there was general prosperity. I mean, there was no reason for the American people to trade Taft for Woodrow Wilson. So the bankers called on an old friend, Theodore Roosevelt, who had set up the National Monetary Commission, and said, Ted, we need you to go in and splinter the Republican vote. So Ted Roosevelt comes out of nowhere, starts the Bull Moose Party, runs for president himself, splits the Republican vote. Woodrow Wilson is a shoo-in, and Taft and Roosevelt, of course, disappear. So now they could have him sign the Federal Reserve Act. But the congressmen from the Middle West and the Far West were totally opposed to even the Federal Reserve Act because they knew it was a phony. And so they were led by Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh of Minnesota. And I've been to his home at Little Falls, Minnesota, and it's a wonderful museum. This man really gave his life to fight the bankers. And, of course, he was the father of the aviator. And Lindbergh led the campaign against the Federal Reserve Act. And so Paul Warburg himself, who was the author of the act, and the other bankers had to, for the first time in their life, come down to Washington and lobby in the halls of Congress to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. And, of course, they had to make a lot of promises, a lot of commitments, a lot of bribes. But since they printed the money, it didn't matter. So they bribed the Congress to enact the Federal Reserve Act, which was signed, but they still could not get a majority vote. So they had to wait till the Christmas vacation after Lindbergh and the Middle Western and Western congressmen had departed for Christmas vacation. Then they brought the Federal Reserve Act before Congress on December 23rd after the opposition had left. But they still had a quorum. They still could pass it. And so even the New York Times said, never has legislation of such importance been passed under such circumstances. In other words, the whole Federal Reserve Act was passed through fraud. It was passed more or less while Congress was in Christmas vacation. And Wilson signed the act into law on December 23rd, practically Christmas Eve, and it became public law. So now that they had a central bank with the power to print all the money they wanted, a privately owned bank, and the Federal Reserve Act itself is an amazing act. It's an act of total monopoly because every word in it, first of all the money that the bankers can print becomes an obligation of the U.S. government, which means the U.S. taxpayer. Second, the stockholders of this private bank included in the legislation that no Federal Reserve Bank stock could ever be bought or sold on any exchange in the world. So in other words, the initial purchasers would own it in perpetuity, which is what happened because the Rothschilds, Warburgs, and Schiffs all bought the original stock in 1914 and have owned it ever since. And they've put it into foundations so it can never be touched. And these foundations are the real government of the United States, Rockefeller Foundation. Nearly all of your major legislation in the United States is prepared by these foundations. And they submit it to Congress, and of course they have enormous staffs and billions of dollars. So they bring the legislation before Congress, and it's impeccable. It's researched and it's phrased, and everything is done just right. And so, of course, the Congress accepts it. And they look around, they say, is anybody objected to any of this? And of course, there's total silence. Nobody objects. So it becomes law. That's why you have laws constantly passed by Congress, which are actively opposed by 85% of the American people. Almost everything is done in Washington is opposed by 85% of the American people. So you have government by 15%, government by elites. And they're not even Americans. These are international elitists. They have no allegiance whatsoever to the United States, just like your Canadian legislatures have no allegiance to you. They have no allegiance to Canada. They're part of the international elite. But of course, they don't say this publicly, and the press hails them all as great patriots and dedicated people, selfless individuals. They love that word, selfless. Imagine, all your legislators are selfless. They never have a selfish bone in their body, because they're working for you. They want to give you things. And, of course, the only purpose they have is to rob you. Not only you, but all 6 billion people in the world, because it's a government of robbery. So you have what you call the new economy in the United States, and probably Canada too. And the new economy is simply people working and creating and producing in spite of everything the robbers can do to them. Everything that's accomplished in this country is accomplished in spite of the foundations, in spite of the bankers. People have to work harder to pay the interest, but they do that. They rise to the challenge. And so they've created a new economy, an economy of enormous prosperity. And the bankers don't like it, because the most influential financial reporter on television in the States is Louis Rukeyser, a Wall Street Week, which is a very honored program, been on for many years. So a couple of months ago, I was watching Wall Street Week, and Louis Rukeyser had some Wall Street people on. And so he said, well, what do you think about what's going on, that the stock market was dropping, you know? In fact, my stocks were dropping $10,000 a week. Just week after week, I was watching my little nest egg dwindle away, you know? But I knew what was going on, and I couldn't do anything about it. I may eventually sue Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, for robbing me, because he robbed me. I mean, I saw $170,000 in stock vanish into thin air. And the stocks themselves were perfectly good. Every one of these companies was actually doing well. The economy was doing well. And Clinton, of course, was busy in the Oval Office. I mean, he wasn't interfering with any of this, you see. They said, listen, Bill, if you'll stay out of your way, you can have all the interns you want. And it sounded good to him, and that's what he did. No, Clinton is the invisible president, believe it or not. He has absolutely no political influence whatsoever. And he has a crew in Washington. There was an FBI agent named Gary Aldrich who was stationed there. He was there during the Bush administration, which was a very staid and proper, even stuffy administration. Then in come the Clintons, a bunch of left-wing loonies, homosexuals, and these people were right out of the 1960s. They were absolute nuts, dope addicts, you name it. None of them could pass a clearance. Most of the Clinton White House staff has never been approved by the FBI. They have no security clearance. They should be arrested when they come to work. So Gary Aldrich wrote a best-selling book about this, he told how Hillary, when Christmas came, Hillary was decorating the Christmas trees with penises and condoms and so forth. And I mean, these people believe in what they're doing. They are the real revolutionaries because they're totally degenerate and totally insane. And I don't mean to impugn anybody, but unfortunately, that's what they are. And Gary Aldrich was horrified at these people. And so the whole Clinton spin allied to denounce Gary Aldrich, that he was really a secret Republican and that he was trying to destroy the Clinton administration. Whenever anybody criticizes Clinton, they call him a Clinton hater. In other words, if you find any fault with Clinton, you must be eaten up with envy and hatred of this wonderful person who's our president, you know. Yeah. And so Clinton hatred is supposed to be the big thing in the United States. But, well, he'll be long gone because, you see, the powers that be decided to get rid of him, and that's really what Greenspan has been doing. They want to get Clinton and Gore out and put in this very proper Republican administration again. It was the same deal that they did in 1980 with Reagan. They simply totally sabotaged Jimmy Carter. They put him on grease skids and ran him right out of Washington. And they're doing the same with Gore. Every reporter in the United States knows that Gore is gone, that he hasn't got the chance of a snowball in hell. And so it's Bush all the way. This is the way that they like unanimity. They like monolithic government. They don't want opposition. So they're going to get rid of Clinton and his gang of bums and put in a very sedate, a nice first lady who has never slept with anybody but her husband, and the whole bit. We're going back to morals. Meanwhile, the same bankers will be running everything just as they did. They'll be doing everything they want. But at least Bush will not do what Reagan will do. What Reagan did, he brought in this bunch of socialists who called themselves conservatives, or neoconservatives. But Bush is bringing in the old CIA crowd. Remember, Bush Sr. was head of the CIA and was a CIA operative all of his life. That's the only job he ever had, really. He had these ships that were CIA passenger ships and everything else, supply ships. And, of course, they sabotaged the Bay of Pigs to ensure that Castro was about to fall in Cuba. He was gone. So they mounted an emergency rescue, the CIA mounted an emergency rescue operation to save Castro, called the Bay of Pigs. And, of course, all of Castro's opposition came out and fought him because they were assured that planes were coming from the United States and they would blow the Castro forces off the map. So when they went out and were fighting on the beaches, they looked up, there were no planes. No planes ever came. So, of course, Castro's opposition was totally wiped out, and he's been in power ever since. It was the same way as Bush did with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They said, we've got to get rid of this new Hitler. Saddam is the new Hitler. We've got to get rid of him. So what happened? Saddam is still in power because he and Bush were partners in a number of enterprises. Saddam, by the way, is one of the wealthiest men in the world. I mean, he's a big player. And he helps keep the price of oil up. See, people are complaining about the price of gasoline. They don't realize that Saddam is doing that. Because if we had the Iraq production coming into this country, gas would be 25 cents a gallon. And so they can't have that. So they keep Saddam in power. And they did the same thing in Iraq. They got rid of all of Saddam's opposition because when the United States attacked Iraq, then obviously every Iraq patriot had to support Saddam Hussein. So he's in for life. And that's the way things are done. You always support the opposition so you can control it. So we own Saddam Hussein. He is not a monster that the press claims. And we support Castro. We've kept Castro in power for 40 years. And this is the way they operate. Well, I mention this because the senior Bush, as head of the CIA, oversaw all these things. So what you're going to have under W, the new president, will be a CIA operation, which is the same as in Russia. You have the KGB running the state. Here we have, we'll have the CIA running things. And here again, the people. At some point, the people will have to make themselves recognized. And they're doing this through the internet. The big question mark is the internet. And that's why Washington has been making frantic efforts to control the internet. So they did it through what they call child pornography. They set up sting operations where guys would try to recruit 12-year-old girls or 12-year-old boys for sex through the internet. And, of course, this did happen, but it happened because it was a sting operation. There weren't thousands of people out there saying, gosh, I want to get some child sex through the internet. It was all set up. And they wanted to use this to close down the internet, to have total government control of the internet. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work. Congress passed the law because when you have those $100,000 cash in envelope things, your votes are very easy to get. And so they passed a law controlling the internet, but the Supreme Court threw it out because it was totally unenforceable. And the internet's going to continue to grow. And I think people are going to continue to assert themselves. And it's like Kathy said yesterday, we're at the beginning of the new revolution. Everything is opening up, and the people are going to have a chance to express themselves and to have government control, because the criminals have exhausted all of their criminal operations. They have all the money, they have all the political power, and yet they're on the way out because time itself is against them. Information is against them. The wheel is turning around, and these people are going to be gone, I'm telling you. Within 10 years, these banking people are going to be gone. My book came out in 1953, has been on the Federal Reserve, has sold over 1 million copies. There's been 8 complete plagiarized editions published by other people, and which was done to punish me, by the way, said I didn't get any money from it. But it helped also to alert people to the Federal Reserve. So the information is out there. It's on its way. And what we have to look forward to, if you think you've seen prosperity yet, you haven't seen nothing yet, because we're going all the way. We're going to full production, and the people are going to get the benefits of their own economy. And so I thank you, and I just wanted to bring you that message of cheer. And this is absolutely as true of Canada as it is in the United States. You know, the first person who brought me to Canada was Eileen Pressler. And I said to her, why is the Canadian dollar below the American dollar? They should be trading at par. She said, because the bankers manipulate it. By keeping the Canadian dollar down, they create all sorts of opportunities for speculation. And great business is going on between the United States and Canada because of the disparity in the currency. And everybody's making money, everybody's happy, and as I say, it's totally, from an economic point of view, it's totally insane that the Canadian dollar would be below the American dollar.
Well, but it's brought to buy up our country. Our country is almost gone.
Well, that's exactly right. They're creating opportunities for speculators, and that's what they're doing. But hopefully that will change too, because what we want is economic equity. We want fairness. We don't want government by criminals, and that's what we've got. These people are criminals. In my book, The Curse of Canaan, I trace it back 5,000 years. These people didn't start yesterday. They have perfected these techniques over thousands of years. They have family dynasties all over the world, and they're simply used to having their own way. But in the modern world, they're totally obsolete, they're totally archaic, and they've got to go, and they're going to go. Thank you. Now, we do have time for a couple of questions, and I'll welcome any questions, and I'll try to answer them. You know, the old The old technique was that you'd be asked a question in a public meeting, and you would say, I'm so glad you asked that question, and then they would proceed not to answer it. But I've never done that. I'll answer any question, and I'll be glad to entertain questions.
What's your name?
Yes.
I missed your name.
Mullins, Eustace Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. People think it's an Irish name, but it's actually French. It's Moulin, which means Miller in French. And
you just squeeze the handle to adjust the height.
Yeah,
just squeeze it.
You made a compelling case for what happened to Lincoln and to Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy with Executive Order 11110, June 4, 63. Do you have anything to say or any confirming information on Garfield and McKinley? Was the same motive behind the assassination of those two presidents?
Well, the assassinations of Garfield and McKinley were done by the bankers because they were working to get this central bank set up, you see. They were planning for it. And both Garfield and McKinley totally objected to it. So they had to be gotten rid of. They were murdered simply because they were in the way of the central bank plan. And almost all of these things that happen because the bankers want them to. See, the average American citizen or Canadian citizen is not really out to assassinate anybody. They might not like a particular politician, but they're not going to assassinate it. The assassinations have to be carefully planned. There has to be a lot of money behind it. Now, what they did with Kennedy, they flew in a group of Sicilian killers from Marseille. They were the ones that actually carried out the assassination. But like I say, they had five teams there because this had to go forward, and they couldn't have any recrimination, and they wanted it to happen. So if one team didn't do it, the other team, and so the Sicilians did it. And they flew into Canada, by the way, to a safe house immediately after the assassination. They stayed here in Canada for 5 days. It's all been documented. And then they flew them back to Marseille. So that's how it was done.
Any comment on Robert Kennedy?
Robert Kennedy was a revenge killing by the mafia. And
I'm sorry, Eustace.
Oh, Robert Kennedy was a revenge killing by the mafia. He was no threat to them anymore because they'd killed his brother. In fact, the happiest moment of J. Edgar Hoover's life was when he picked up the phone and called Robert Kennedy and said, "Your brother has been killed," and he hung up. And Robert Kennedy was devastated by that. He never recovered because they really hated each other. Actually, Robert Kennedy hated homosexuals, first place, and he simply considered that J. Edgar Hoover, as head of the FBI, was totally subordinate to the Attorney General. Well, all the previous Attorney Generals had allowed J. Edgar Hoover to do whatever he wanted to because they were pretty much afraid of him. Kennedy was the first person that ever opposed him. And Kennedy, by the way, was murdered in the Ambassador Hotel. Now, the Rony Plaza Hotel in Miami Beach was the winter headquarters of the Mafia, and that's where J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson spent their winter vacations. So, but Robert Kennedy was murdered in the Ambassador Hotel, which was also a Shine hotel, a Mafia hotel. See, the Mafia recruited a guy named J. Meyer Shine to handle their real estate interests, mostly movies and hotels. And so with the Mafia money, J. Meyer Shine built these lavish hotels and movie theaters around the United States, which were all Mafia stuff. And so when Robert Kennedy went to the Ambassador Hotel, he had no idea he was walking into the hands of the enemy. I'm sure he had no idea that there was a Mafia hotel. And because Robert Kennedy was a different person from myself. We worked together on the McCarthy Committee, by the way. But Robert Kennedy, with all of his money and influence, he had other people do things. Well, I never had anybody do anything. If I wanted to do anything, I had to go and research it myself. The result was all of my information was firsthand. Everything Robert Kennedy got was filtered to him. And as I say, when he went to the Ambassador Hotel, he had no idea he was walking into his own assassination. I would have known that. I would have known it was a Shine Hotel. And Shine, by the way, his son David, was the Shine-Cohn partnership which sabotaged McCarthy's fight against the communists. McCarthy let me go in order to hire Conan Schein. So I have a personal memoir of that.
Well, first, Eustace, thanks so much for accepting Wes's invitation to bring your experience to Canada. What's your take on JFK's Jr.? Was that just a Washington airplane he was using, like a Washington heart attack?
JFK made a fatal mistake. First of all, he was a very dangerous person because he was the most famous celebrity in the United States. Second, he had $150 million of his own. Third, he had his own national magazine. This makes you an extremely dangerous person. And fourth, he had decided to do an all-out expose of Mossad and the Anti-Defamation League as the most dangerous influence in American politics. Well, when you go embark on a program like that, you're going to develop some engine trouble.
Second question.
You talked about Rothschild basically financing the buying of the Jewish homeland. But my understanding is Rothschild is not actually Jewish to begin with himself at all, is it? The original dynasty isn't Jewish, is it?
Well, the original dynastic name was Bauer, which means peasant in German. But as far as I know, the Rothschild family has always been Jewish as far back as I can find out. Even when they were Bauers, they were Jews and they were in the money business. See, the Jewish people during the Middle Ages were mostly in the rag merchant business. They dealt in secondhand clothes, and then they went into other businesses, but they always wound up in the money business because they were the advantage they had was they were international, just like the five Rothschild brothers set up in the five capitals of Europe, and by that means we could control the whole European area.
Yes, we wouldn't mind being peasants as well, then.
No, yeah.
But it's funny when you talk about, you know, we talk about Bill Gates being the richest man in the world. It's funny how when they always do those lists, there's never any bankings on the list.
No, that's forbidden. Forbes and all these people know they can't put any of those people on the lists, and they never appear on the lists.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, with the royalty of England originally coming from Germany, why was Hitler so able to launch such an attack against England and coming quite close to finishing it off?
Well, it's called international finance. You say the royal family of England owned half of the Ethel patents, and all of the German planes which were bombing London, the royal family of England was getting royalties on the gasoline they were burning. So it's just a matter of business.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins, for coming. I want you to speak a little bit on vaccinations, because that's been a big issue in my life over 20 years. And number two, did you know Ayn Rand? And you probably did. And what kind of lady was she, really?
Well, Ayn Rand was the disciple of a new conservatism, and Alan Greenspan, who's now chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, was one of her principal pupils. And she believed in an enlightened selfishness, which in itself is fine. But she was very influential. She's sort of the patron saint of the National Review, which is the organ of neoconservatism in the United States, the Bill Buckley organization. And Bill Buckley, of course, was a CIA operative all his life. And the National Review is a CIA paper. And its gods are Jean Kirkpatrick and Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. And so none of these people have anything to offer in the way of truth or justice. And in fact, people like myself are considered a non-person by the National Review. Bill Buckley and I started out at the same time. But with Bill Buckley's CIA backing, he got national publicity, and I got none. So that's the way it goes.
What about vaccinations?
Oh, vaccinations, I have a chapter on that in my Murder by Injection book. And vaccinations are probably the most toxic substance you can introduce into the human body. Plus, they're deliberately engineered that the immune system cannot fight them, cannot expel them, and so they stay in your system throughout your life. And quote medical authorities who say that every vaccination is a time bomb in the human system, which at some point, maybe 25, even 50 years, is going to erupt in a stroke, heart attack, or other or cancer. So you're carrying this, if you've been vaccinated, you carry this time bomb in your system, and you don't know when it's going to blow up, and you're going to fall over with a stroke or heart attack.
What is their purpose?
The purpose there, I think, is to ensure a lifetime of poor health and constant consumption of drugs and medications. Because, after all, if the Rockefellers, they control every major drug company, they want to see the business coming in, you know. You want that bottom line, and you want that those growth figures for the next 10 years. So it's all planned, and it's deliberately planned. Everything that they do, and including vaccination, is planned to attack the immune system and make you incapable of ever seeing good health again in your lifetime.
Thank you for your truth.
Surely.
Would you comment on the Norfed dollar, if you know about it, and other monies that's being printed that's backed by gold and silver in the States?
Yes, I'm familiar with the Norfed operation. In fact, I'm a member of it, and it's a way out. But until we get control of our own currency, Norfed itself is a very small operation. And what we simply need is to go into the Federal Reserve System and arrest everybody. I had a friend who did that, by the way. He went into the Federal Reserve Building on Constitution Avenue, the Marble Palace, and he was going to arrest the members of the Federal Reserve Board, which is the only thing to do because conspiracy to rob people is a definitely statutory offense. And that's what they do there. They rob everybody through these planned... I have a lot of material here on the Greenspan and the fact that his so-called fight against inflation is total... It's considered total nonsense by every economic writer in the world.
Any more questions? Oh, here we go.
I knew you had to be here sooner or later.
You mentioned that the Zionists said that they believed that you could not have a state of Israel until the coming of the Messiah.
No, that was the Orthodox Jews. That's Orthodox Judaism. The Zionists came up with an alternative on Reform Judaism that you could go ahead and have a Jewish state without the Messiah coming.
So the Zionists believe that you can have an Israeli state then?
Oh, yes, and they did. That's how they achieved it, because until they came along with this alternative plan, the Jewish community of the world would never accept Jewish state without the Messiah.
So that must have been bought and paid for by...
Oh, the Rothschilds put every penny into into Palestine. They sent the settlers out there. They paid all of their expenses, bought the land for them, set up great operations, wineries, agricultural things. All that was Rothschild money.
And all the controversy right now going on in there between the Palestinians, you know, that's just got to be a big banking operation, it seems to me, connected with oil.
Oh, very much so. If you go to the State of Israel, you'll see the main street is called Rothschild Boulevard. The entire Israeli parliament was donated by Jacob Rothschild of London. In other words, imagine if a private American donated the entire building of the United States. And that's what happened in Israel. It's all donated by the Rothschilds.
Eustace, first of all, congratulations on all your outstanding work you've done through the years. I've known and heard of you for a number of years myself. I've been in the issue myself for some 20 years. But back in 1950, I have information, I haven't been able to confirm it yet, maybe you can help me, that the Senate Intelligence Committee put out a 3- or 4-volume report which listed all the communists in America and all their affiliations. Nellie Roosevelt was in there, supposedly. I don't know how many lists of organizations she belonged to. And when LBJ came into office, the word I have is that he ordered that all of them be destroyed. And I understand there are 7 or 8 of them that have not been destroyed. Do you have any idea where I might be able to find one of those?
I really do not, because, of course, when they order those books destroyed, they're pretty thorough. Now, I do know that in the Army and Department of State, now whether it's under Truman or not, I'm not sure, all files concerning communist affiliation of government employees were destroyed. The whole Army was totally cleaned out. And in fact, when I knew Joe McCarthy, he still depended on the FBI for a lot of information. Bob Serene was the main person who was bringing him information. And they fired Bob Serene later on, too, unfortunately. But, McCarthy's information came from the FBI.
I'm aware of that. And liaison from, I was in the FBI 27 years, by the way. And the second question I'd like to ask you is, I've contended, having no documentation, of course, that the downfall of the wall in Berlin and the downfall of communism was all a facade in order for us to weaken our defenses and cut back and take over the country, Canada and the United States, from within. How do you feel about that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. There was a Soviet defector named Galinsky. You may know his book. And Galinsky outlined all this in detail about 15 or 20 years ago. And Galinsky's book is hard to find, but it's all in there.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Sure.
Isn't Galinsky the defected general who said that Clinton was in Moscow for 3 years during his youth and was being trained by the KGB?
Oh, yes. Clinton had advanced training in Moscow.
Was that Galinsky's book?
I'm not sure if it's Galinsky or not, but there are other sources on that. There's no question about it.
Right.
Clinton, well, now some people claim that Clinton was actually a CIA operative, which is possible too, you know, because you know yourself, you have double agents, triple agents, quadruple agents. And so we all have this idea that a person can only work for one group at a time. In fact, a guy who has ability, everybody wants him, and they don't care if he's a double or triple agent. They want him on their side. So a lot of these people work for four or five different outfits.
Okay, thank you very much.
Surely.
Good morning. I've studied John Nelson's work. Are you familiar with John?
John Nelson?
John Nelson.
In Colorado?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I've been a correspondent.
One of the things that he really hammered home and in some of his information is that you cannot contract with yourself, and all notes, legal tender, have two signatures on it representing the government, of which if you can't contract with yourself, one of them's not of local properties. Therefore, all dollars are really international obligations. And when going into court, therefore, in a tax issue, you should be pleading international law because what they're collecting from you is an international obligation. Would you concur with that theory?
Well, obligations are contractual, and they're covered by the law. And the only thing you can do to protect yourself is uphold your contractual obligations and hope that the other side upholds them. And this is where legal ability comes in, because if they don't uphold their contractual obligations, then you have the ability to sue them. But there again, it's an adversary situation, and what it comes down to is your individual responsibility to defend your own interests. And you cannot defend your own interests by going out and hiring a lawyer or by going into a court and expecting justice, because any judge in the States and probably Canada also, as Ernest Zundel can tell you, you go into a court looking for justice, the judges laugh their heads off. They know it doesn't exist.
Thank you. I'd just like to know what you feel about that Columbine massacre that happened there a couple of years ago.
In the
schools there?
Well, the whole Columbine episode was part of Clinton's gun control operation. And the two alleged students who did this, we don't know whether they did or not. We don't know if they ever fired a shot, as a matter of fact. But they were on very strong medication. And with that kind of medication, you get hallucinations, delusions, and you also come under mind control. I'm sure Kathy could tell you a lot about that. So if they did what they did it because they were under mind control, because teenagers normally do not shoot their fellow students, nor do they commit suicide. But you see, under mind control, once you have carried out the operation, then you are instructed to commit suicide. So that it must have been a standard mind control operation.
Eustace, I hate to monopolize the questions, but I'm going to give you one more question.
Surely.
And an observation. I noticed in these school shootings and church shootings, I've contended all along it was CIA mind control in most instances.
Oh, yes.
In order to pass the legislation that would do away with the Second Amendment, right to bear arms. I noticed the newspaper articles the first day or maybe a day and a half after the shootings, where they go in and search the homes of the shooters, and about half of them, the newspapers reported they found satanic drawings in the homes.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I've been involved in, you know, investigating Satanism for a number of years, and I contend that these shootings are not only CIA mind control, but dovetails into the satanic movement itself. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, definitely. In fact, many adolescents are taken by these games like Guns and Dragons and all this sort of stuff. So there's a lot of that. It appeals to the adolescent mind, this sort of stuff, because it's costumes and rituals and excitement and different from the mundane world that they live in. So they're very susceptible to this, and once they get into it, then they're drawn into rituals and drugs and so forth, and some of them are already on drugs anyway. So they're simply being manipulated because adolescents are very easy to manipulate because they're inexperienced and they're responsive to adults, and so they're easy to control.
Okay, last one. No problem.
Okay. What's your view on the Masonic movement?
Well, I've written about that extensively in my book, The Curse of Canaan, and I trace it back 5,000 years to the original Babylon and to Nimrod. Nimrod was the first Masonic ruler of the world, and he ruled by total evil. And, of course, they had their satanic rituals, and they had human sacrifice. You name it, they had it. And that's been more continuous throughout history. As I point out in The Curse of Canaan, they periodically have to go underground because their crimes are exposed. And so they go underground and disappear and reappear as something else a couple of hundred years later. You have to have a long time frame in order to study these things because, as I say, these movements may totally disappear for 300 years and then they appear in another country in a total different guise. So you just have to watch for the telltale signs, what they do and what kind of people are doing it. And so it's a matter of observation and experience. You have to know what to look for. It's like any investigative work. If you don't know what you're looking for, it's not going to come up and hit you in the head. You got to go find it.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we do have to wrap up. Tape time, I think, is probably coming to an end, and we have to get on with the rest of the speakers. So, Eustace Mullins, thank you very, very much for your work. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.